Here's why you need to attend the Recruitment Coach Live Summit in London this September. Reason number one is networking. The opportunity to connect in person with like-minded recruitment business owners and share strategies and best practices. Of course, you can do that via Zoom or Teams, but the connection is deeper when you do it in real life. Wouldn't you agree? One of our previous attendees, Darcy, said that she loved the speakers and the content, but the best part for her was in between the sessions, the informal conversations with other successful business owners that sparked incredible insights and those aha moments. The quality of people in the room will be incredible, including many of the people you've heard me interview on this podcast. There's going to be big billing recruiters as well as business owners with multi-million pound businesses. What they all have in common is that they prioritize their own development. And no matter how successful they already are, they want to keep learning and growing. What's even more special and remarkable about this group is that they're all willing to share their knowledge and they're so generous at helping each other improve. Early bird pricing is still available. Register now by visiting recruitmentcoach.com/summit.
Welcome to the Resilient Recruiter Podcast. This is your host, Mark Whitby, and I'm very happy to be joined today by Stephen Lee. Stephen is the Senior Division Director at Robert Half Japan, specializing in cybersecurity recruiting. In 2022, Stephen was recognized as the top biller for the whole of APAC, as well as managing the number one perm team. Stephen's got a passion for creating a safer cybersecurity community in Japan, and he's renowned for his cybersecurity events. So he hosts these events at prestigious venues such as Microsoft, Google, the British Embassy, and Deloitte, and he aims to unite industry professionals to share knowledge and insights. Prior to his successful recruitment career, Stephen gained valuable experience in market risk oversight within the financial markets in Australia. Stephen, welcome. Great to see you again.
Great to see you again too. Well, as well, Mark. So thank you so much for the nice introduction.
Absolutely. I'm really looking forward to this one. Can you just give a bit of context and share the story of how we know each other?
So actually, I remember you were just starting out this podcast, and I think I heard your name from Greg Savage. And I thought, hey, I want to reach out to Mark and book some time with him to have a chat. And I think at that stage, I was just starting out in my business. And I remember that conversation. You had a look at my LinkedIn profile, you gave me some tips. And I think having that encouragement early on in my career to say that, hey, you're on the right track, because what I was doing was different. You know, I was spending time on my LinkedIn profile, I was just spending time on building communities. And you kind of saw that and you said, hey, keep doing what you're doing. I'm rooting for you in your career. I think you're gonna go someplace. And here we are 3 years later having this conversation now. So I'm really honored to be here. And, you know, really appreciate that kind little bit of guidance and support back in the day as well.
Amazing. Well, I could definitely tell from our first conversation that you were definitely going places. Stephen, how and why did you get into recruiting? Because you were in financial services before, right?
So I was in financial services. I always thought that in my job and thinking about my career, if I stayed in that job, I would be average at best. The kind of people that I was competing with are PhDs, math geniuses. And I thought, look, this is the only place I could go, but I felt like my true strength was in a sales role. And actually, before I came here, I actually got help by a recruiter. And she helped me with my first job transition to a company called Westpac. And she made it look so easy, because what she did is she placed me from one market risk oversight role to another in a competitor with a higher salary and a higher position title. And I was like, hey, that looks so easy, right? And I remember just thinking, as you know, like that wasn't the case, right? When I first started, if I take it back to when I first started, in the first 6 months, I only made one placement. And I thought, well, I didn't quit my job in financial markets for this. And everything started to change when I started to specialize in security and started building communities in this space.
Amazing. So are you from Australia, or you just spend a lot of time there working?
I'm from Australia.
You're from Australia. Okay. So why did you move to Japan then?
So Japan is one of my favorite places to travel. I've been here about 6 or 7 times before moving. And there was always this desire to move overseas. I spent some time in Hong Kong on secondment. And I think at that time it was like, yeah, let's go somewhere overseas to work and live. A lot of my colleagues in the banking sector tended to go to the UK, but I felt like there was a calling to Japan. And I think the 35 to 40% fees in Japan are hard to say no to as well.
Absolutely. I know. I've heard that. It's like to us in the UK, that sounds crazy. And even in the US where it's, you know, let's say 25 to 30% is fairly typical. We'll get into that. I want to learn more about your market and everything and how it works. But so did you move to Japan and get into recruiting at the same time, or were you already in Tokyo?
So I was really lucky. So I remember interviewing for a bunch of places while I was visiting, and with Robert Half, I was at the end of my trip. They were open to interviewing. So, but at that stage, I was like, man, I'm pretty tired. I just want to go home. But we kicked off the interviews remotely while I was still in Australia. I spoke to my boss, Lindsay Hughes. He was talking about which areas I could fit into, and he gave me the idea of actually going into cybersecurity from that point. So he's the one who had that vision, and I kind of borrowed that intuition that, hey, there's a market here. There's something for me to do in this space.
Awesome. All right. Love it. So then you mentioned a few minutes ago that in the beginning, you really struggled at the start and you made one placement in your first 6 months. Tell me about what you were feeling and thinking during that first 6 months.
So I remember my boss promised me 6 months of help when you first begin, and no doubt the market always delivers. You start to get some small wins in the start where, you know, you're getting some interviews, and then all of a sudden you're getting some send outs where your candidates are interviewing with clients, and then you get to close to final stage, and then all of a sudden things don't work out. So you build up this imaginary pipeline in your head that, oh, I think, you know, these deals are going to close. But of course, you don't have enough reference points to know that, well, even if they do get the offer, they may accept another offer somewhere else or things close. So I think in my mind, there's a lot of uncertainty because you don't have those reference points to say, what can I expect to happen next? And that uncertainty kind of, you know, you do feel that insecurity is like, hey, is this a job for me? Did I quit my job in financial markets to go into this? To just help one person. So a lot of those feelings come up and you think, oh, what's missing, right? But I was very lucky to have a lot of colleagues around me to help, you know, help provide those reference points. And I think the thing that I focused on was what I can control, which was, am I learning something new every day? Am I getting just 1% better in my business? And I really took that mindset and really, really embedded that to make sure I'm learning each time, each process, each thing, each day. And that really what helped get me through that period.
That's amazing, Stephen, because this is the point at which a lot of rookie recruiters would drop out, right? Because it is, you know, it's a complex dynamic. Like a lot of people, I've heard this expression so often, it's not rocket science. I hate that expression because it makes it seem as if it should be easy, right? The reality is that, you know, just because something is simple doesn't mean that it's easy. So an example I would give is like, let's take running a marathon. Well, it's simple. You just put one foot in front of the other and you just run, right? It's not rocket science. And yet actually getting across the finish line is not easy. You know, it's challenging. And it's in recruiting where you have, you know, you're bringing two parties together. It's such a complex dynamic system with so many variables, and it I think maybe it's easy to do recruiting and be okay, but it's the kind of thing that really mastering it and mastering your craft really, I think, takes time, and it takes a real desire to want to operate at that level. So kudos to you for not like thinking, oh no, I made a mistake, and dropping out. What gave you that tenacity to really stick with it and have the almost the faith that it is going to turn around. You are going to be able to pull it off.
Wow. Just on your marathon analogy, but for myself, I struggle with long distance. I consider 5 kilometers long distance. So it's definitely right. definitely a struggle. What gave me hope? Actually seeing a lot of my colleagues. So seeing a lot of my colleagues and what they were able to produce, they were, I know some places it's very hard to ask for advice, but everyone opened up and they would tell you that, hey, this is actually normal. What you go through, this almost like trial by fire, where you go through this wilderness of not knowing, are you going to make it? Are you going to make it? Everyone goes through that. And yeah. what they held on to was just focus on one placement at a time, focus on getting better. It's just part of the process. So that's what really got me through is their knowledge, their wisdom from the people that went before me. So I was really lucky to have that experience shared with me.
Absolutely. I think, yeah, having peers and role models and colleagues and that kind of environment where people are supportive is huge. So you're definitely fortunate to have had that support. I remember when I very first started in recruiting, I was a slow starter as well. And I started around the same time as a friend of mine, Brian, who's I'm still good friends with. He was one of my first friends when I moved to the UK. And he was the opposite. He was fast out of the gates. Like he had a few deals pretty quickly, and which made me feel bad because I was like, oh man, what? Like I suck. Why is he getting this success and I'm not? But actually, the impact he then almost subconsciously started thinking, oh, this is easy, or I'm like, you know, I'm awesome at recruiting. And the reality is like, there's, as you said, when you were starting out, you did have deals that might have come to fruition, but just it didn't go in your favor. And he got a little bit of luck at the beginning, right? Where things did close. And then he almost got into a false sense of security and took his foot off the gas a little bit. And it was like a rabbit, like tortoise and hare scenario. I was the tortoise, he was the hare, and he kind of fell asleep halfway, you know. And then I overtook him because he thought it was actually easier than it was, and he didn't respect the effort and the, you know, the endurance that it takes to really, you know, make this sustainable and not just have these, you know, peaks of production. Can you talk us through your, now, by the way, I want to give people the full context, Stephen, like being the top biller across APEC at Robert Half, which is a huge global organization. And you've been doing this for how long? 3 years now?
About 3.5 years now, but at the time it was three.
At the time, right, is 3 years. Stephen, is absolutely bonkers with only 3 years experience to be the top biller in APEC. Could you talk us through your strategy and how you have accomplished that?
It's a great question. So I remember in 2020, so just following on the narrative when things really sucked, I only made one placement. And to make it worse, the 2020 recession hit in. So that came in and management was saying, guys, we need to work harder and we need to work smarter. And I told them like, hey, I'm from Gen Y. I don't like working harder, but I will work smarter. And I looked at a lot of successful people around me and a lot of them they had 10 years, 15 years experience, very, very knowledgeable, very respected in what they do. And being impatient, I thought, well, I don't want to wait that long to get there. How do I get there quicker? And this idea came to me. And I remember when I first started out, I listened to Greg Savage and his wisdom. He talks about this idea of celebrity branding or being a mini celebrity in your marketplace. And I connected that to this idea of how do you build relationships at scale in recruitment, because it's all about a business of building trust. And that's when we started doing these meetup events. So we started doing these meetup events. I did the first two in my office. Our office sucked at the time. And I also made a lot of mistakes throughout the process. So the first, if I take you back to 2020, the first one we did was a meetup around hardware hacking. First of all, I had people too fast spread out in the room. The second thing was people who came, some were in security. There were some people out of security, so the target audience wasn't so fine-tuned. And the third, the most fatal mistake I made was I did not have enough alcohol for these cybersecurity professionals. These guys literally run on caffeine and alcohol. And fortunately, I didn't make that mistake too often again in the future. But it was a nice little lesson.
Let me just first pause here, Stephen, because so I understand you were inspired by Greg Savage, and he talks about building talent communities, which I 100% agree with. And by the way, for all our listeners, I believe, like Greg's been talking about this for years, talent communities, but I believe that community is going to be, or has, you have the opportunity to make it the most important strategy of 2023 is building community and being not a vendor or supplier to your market, but being actually in your market, being a leader in your market and being someone who people recognize as a peer, as someone who's bringing value and someone who's actually in the fabric of your ecosystem. You're very prominent and visible and not just, you know, selling recruiting services or looking to recruit people, but you are bringing people together and helping to elevate your industry that you serve. But what it's unusual for someone so early in their career to actually implement what, you know, is could be seen as quite an advanced strategy. Like what, how did you decide events? Like I'm going to host events, like meetups. How did you decide that that was going to be your the main vehicle for you to build your market?
To be honest, I'm not so good at creating original ideas. That's my caveat. I'm very lucky to tap into a network of people who do have a lot of good ideas. And I remember I was having drinks with Thomas, and he's the person that runs these cyber risk meetups with me. And as all good ideas developed over some drinks, I said, hey, we should do these meetups. And the crazy thing was, or the interesting thing was, is that someone else was already doing meetups at the time. So someone else was in this market doing it. And
by someone else, do you mean a competitor or another recruiter?
Another recruiter, yeah. Actually. Yeah, yeah. So that kind of tells me, number one, that there's demand in this market because people are getting together. But number two, it reminded me of the story of Dropbox. Before they came into the marketplace, 100 people were doing the same thing. But we thought, well, why don't we do it a little bit differently and add our own flavor? And our mission sort of evolved from there. I said, okay, instead of just getting together and having drinks at a meetup, why don't we get together to give people the platform to share their ideas and best practices? And I'll give you an example of one of the conversations that happened during the meetup. Is people were sharing a bit about their security awareness training strategy. So they said, hey, we're working on this security awareness training strategy. Here are the challenges we're faced. Here are the findings that we're having. And then someone else from another company said, hey, we're actually working on exactly the same thing. Wouldn't it be cool if we got together and actually worked across companies to share best practices on this particular topic, especially because the materials there had to be in Japanese, which can be quite cumbersome for a lot of people who are working, who are not native Japanese speakers. So that kind of got me thinking about, you know, the mission kind of evolved into like, we're just getting together as a group of people, but we're really getting together to share best practices. And if I relate that back to one of the biggest problems in the cybersecurity industry, is that there is a shortage of talent here in the market. It's not going away. You hear quotes being thrown around like this 200,000 people short in APAC. If you spread that out to the US and global, that number escalates even further. So how do we address that problem when we're not getting enough resources? So I feel like if we share those ideas with each other, that's a first step towards addressing that problem.
So you and Thomas, your colleague, were having drinks. You you brainstorm this idea. I just want to point out to people what you said, which is that there's already at least one other person in your market doing it, but that didn't deter you. And I think that is key, because so many, like whatever idea you have, I guarantee you there's someone already doing it, whether it's to do a meetup, whether it's to do, you know, do videos on LinkedIn, whether it's to launch a podcast, whatever marketing idea you have, there is probably someone already doing it. But that doesn't mean you should scratch that off your list and not go for it, because, you know, maybe you can do it better, or maybe you can put your own spin on it and come at it from a different angle, or find a way to differentiate what you're doing. So just to clarify, when you say meetup, are you using the platform meetup.com, or you're just using that as a term to, you know, for this type of event?
Both. So when we started, it was on meetup.com was the platform, and then we quickly transitioned to LinkedIn. And there are certain benefits of using the LinkedIn tool, because it integrates better with your audience who are already on LinkedIn. Mm-hmm. When you post the event, people can see their friends who are attending, because if they click attend, it'll come up in their feed to say, so-and-so is attending, right? So that gets them thinking, if so-and-so or Greg Savage is attending, I also want to attend as well.
Got it.
So it kind of pushes it through other people's feeds more compared to if I copied and pasted a meetup link into LinkedIn. And the reason for that is LinkedIn rewards content on their own platform, instead of if you post things external to it, it will essentially punish you.
I agree 100%. So do you still use the meetup platform, or you've gone 100% to LinkedIn now?
100% LinkedIn.
Okay, interesting. Talk about the evolution of those events and how that has kind of snowballed for you and what you've learned along the way, Stephen.
Besides making sure there's enough alcohol at the events, these events have really evolved into just starting out at our own company's venues to being hosted at other people's venues. I think people are interested to see, you know, what's it like at Google? What's it like at Microsoft? What's it like at the British Embassy? It does create a different atmosphere. And then it evolved into, instead of having just one talk, why don't we do two talks? And I try and do, because we typically have them on a Friday night, mm-hmm. right? So it will start from 6 p.m. We will start the official part of the meetup at 6:30, where we'll have the talks, and we'll have one lightning talk, which is about 10-15 minutes. Then we'll have a main talk with 20 minutes with Q&A, and we try and wrap up everything within an hour, because it's a Friday night. People don't want to be sold anything. They don't want to be sitting in a lecture that's too long, but it needs to be relevant for their marketplace. So some of the topics that we have talked about before are things like, what are some of the challenges that a CISO has? How does a CISO hire? So we talked about some of the leadership topics, which is some of the expertise that I can bring, but I also get a lot of the engineers to talk about some of the things that they've been working on. So we talked a little bit about software supply chain security. We talked about variant analysis, server-side request forgery, and cloud security misconfiguration. And those were all from people in the community bringing up those topics.
How do you select your topics? And because this is key, is choosing something that people are actually really interested in. That's going to be, so I think that what draws people to this kind of event, it's going to be, number one, some people just want the opportunity to network, and it's a bit of a social, it's an opportunity to meet their peers and share ideas, right? But especially if they're kind of siloed in their business and they don't have other colleagues to talk cybersecurity with, right? So this is, you're creating that opportunity, but definitely the speaker and the topic are huge as to whether someone can be bothered turning up or not, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Especially if, as you mentioned, if people don't know anyone there, because it can be quite intimidating. You see, you know, you're going to a new place where everyone, you feel like everyone knows each other. But if there's a topic that's interesting to you, you may take that risk to say, yeah, I'm going to go check it out.
Yeah.
Right? And especially it's on a Friday night too. So you might have other things to do on that night.
Totally. So how have you generated the topic ideas then?
So from a topic idea perspective, just speaking to people in the market, you hear what's hot, what's moving. You hear, you know, you speak to people and you feel like, hey, these people would be a good public speaker. And I think there would be more people who would be interested in this topic because other people have talked about it as well. So you do want to bring a topic that resonates with your market. And I think from there, it's just about selecting the best person you feel from that area.
Totally. That makes sense. And then how did you get the opportunity to like host the events at Google or the British Embassy?
So we're very lucky. So my boss is friends with the guy at the British Embassy.
Okay.
And they also had interest in promoting cyber from an embassy perspective. Mm-hmm. And some of the other places, as we started running more of these meetup events, people actually come up to you and ask you, hey, that was a really cool event. Can we also do the same thing at a Google, at a Microsoft? So it starts to snowball and people, you know, it's not just my event, but they see it as their event as well, where they can contribute and give back to the community. And that's something really special that I've seen in the cybersecurity spaces where people want to do that.
That's awesome. Posting. Yeah, no, Stephen, it's so cool how, and this is something I want people to really, really get is, when you're doing something that, of course, there's a benefit. We're going to talk about like the business benefits in a minute, but you're also doing something in service to your market, your ecosystem, and that there's not an immediate monetary value to you, right? You're giving value upfront in order to build relationships with people that, you know, we'll come back to you. It always comes back to you in some way, shape, or form, but you're creating something that you almost cannot predict the opportunities or the people that this will attract into your life, into your world. That's what I found with this podcast. Like the opportunities and the incredible people that this has attracted are just, every day I'm astounded and I would never have predicted. And I couldn't have, it's not like I set out to bring those people, like, cause I didn't even know them. I didn't know that those opportunities were available. And so that's what you're seeing is you're putting something really awesome out there and it snowballs and results in things that you almost wouldn't have even dared to imagine, right? Like, you probably didn't set a goal like when you were having drinks with Thomas. Hey, let's host these events at Google, right? Like you probably wouldn't have even imagined that. So, talk about what sort of numbers are you getting along to these events?
So the numbers of people that we're getting to these events when we first started it was like 20,
which is good.
20,
I mean,
25, which is a decent amount.
Yeah,
and you know, we held our last one at Microsoft and we got over 100 registrations and about 80 people turned up.
So I want to point out two things. Number one, that's 500% more than your first event. I honestly would have been happy with 20 because it's not just about numbers. It's about quality as well. It's the quality of people that you're bringing together. But, and also the show up rate, is there any kind of charge or is it completely free?
It's completely free. So okay. the other thing that's really great about the community is that, you know, we hosted these events at their venue. They cover the full cost of it so that it's free for everyone to join. So there's no barriers to entry on that side. So I don't directly, you know, I don't make anything from it directly. Yep. But in terms of the ROI, I remember when I first started doing these things, people would ask me like, hey, Stephen, what's the ROI on these events? And I'm like, I don't know, bro. It's been like 2 weeks. And you're absolutely right. These conversations kind of... You don't know where these conversations will go. And, you know, I might add that something really amazing has happened as well for us is that I was doing this 3 years ago and now Robert Half in Japan is actually known for hosting community events.
Wow.
So all of a sudden we have different teams like the data team, the consulting team, the software engineering team, the executive search team. they've all started their own community events to bring people together as well. So that's something really special that I'm really proud of, that that's kind of inspired other people to do it. And it's something, it's funny how it's not something that I've asked people to do, but they've done it. But the things that I do ask them to do, it doesn't get done. But,
right,
but it's
exactly.
Amazing what people pick up.
The motivation has to come from them to do it. So really, really interesting. So the host company will actually provide, like they'll put on the drinks and the nibbles and all that kind of stuff.
Correct.
So it didn't, but whereas the first couple, Robert Half had to foot the bill. Was that a, did you have to really pitch your boss on the benefits to get the, you know, the budget for that?
Actually my boss was very supportive.
Cool.
So he was very supportive and said, hey, whatever you need, we'll help provide it. And I was very lucky for that because, you know, when you first start out, you're not making a whole amount of placements. You're not making a whole amount of bank. So to have that support from the company and say, hey, we'll give you people to help with running the event too, that was super, super helpful.
Fantastic. I love that. So what do you feel have been the biggest benefits looking back over now that you've been doing this for, how long have you been running these events?
So we did two in 2020, and then basically there were some lockdowns in Japan, which made it very difficult to have gatherings of people.
Yes, of course.
And that lasted for quite a while. So that lasted for about a year and a half. And I had to pivot away to webinars during that time.
Mm-hmm.
I had to pivot to webinars. But some of the benefits that we're seeing is that people know who you are without ever having met you. And a part of that is also what you talked about in a previous session where you were being interviewed, is LinkedIn posting and personal branding, right? There's this idea called celebrity endorsement. So I always say that the LinkedIn post that I do after the event is probably just as important as the event itself, because people see you with people they know. They could be with famous CISOs. They could be with their friends they used to work with. And all of a sudden, there's a sense of familiarity when they see those pictures. And, you know, if there's enough pictures of you with people in your relevant market, they'll start to automatically think in their brain that, hey, seems like Steven's got something to do with security. It's almost if I was a bodybuilder and I was taking pictures with all these other bodybuilders like Ronnie Coleman, Arnold Schwarzenegger, past Mr. Olympia, people are going to think you have something to do with that industry. So it's the same thing with how Instagram works as well.
Absolutely. So this is really powerful, Steven. Could you say a little more about like how you promote the event, like kind of before and after?
Sure. So I post the event on LinkedIn. So LinkedIn has this new feature called Events, where you've got a dedicated page to hosting the events and you can see the entire guest list. Then most places are restricted in the number of people they can host just because of venue logistics, and you also had the COVID rules before. So then we get people to register via form, and then we run a lottery to select who'll be able to come from that, you know, to make it fair.
That's interesting.
And then after the event, I'll post a picture, and I won't just say, "Hey, really nice event at Microsoft, and thank you all so much for coming." People are looking for some insight, like, what were the key takeaways? What was your key takeaways from the event? You know, and sometimes if your mind was drawing a blank or you were busy doing other things throughout the conversations, is you can get other people to help fill in those blanks too. So you can ask them, hey, what are the key takeaways that you took away from it, so I can post it up? And I've done that once or twice as well. But they're really looking for, what are the key takeaways? What surprised you? What stood out to you from there? What did you notice? Maybe it's not about the content itself, but what did you notice about the types of people that come? What did people talk about on the side, not just with that main topic? And people are quite interested in what you have to say. People are looking for an opinion. And for some reason, people are afraid to share their opinion or takeaways on LinkedIn.
It's so I can imagine this gives you such a wealth of ideas for other spin-off content on LinkedIn, because you really do have a deep understanding of your market, about the challenges, the, you know, the hot topics, and, you know, the key discussion points that are happening amongst, you know, the cybersecurity community. So that means, you know, you can post really relevant stuff on LinkedIn, kind of in between your live events as well. I think this is so powerful.
For sure. And just to add to that as well, like, you know, I go to the extreme with this, but my life is intertwined with this community, where, you know, I'm new to Japan. A lot of the friends I have are actually from this community. So I've intertwined that. And to give you an idea, that we host these events from about 6 to 9 p.m. Mm-hmm. The one at Microsoft went to 10 p.m. because we still had about 50 people there who were like, let's go to second drinks. So from 10 p.m., and this is what typically happens, from like 10 p.m. to 12 p.m. in Japan, we have our third drinks, or second or third drinks. And then it runs all the way till about 2 a.m., 3 a.m., 4 a.m. sometimes. People are hanging out, and we're really like, it doesn't seem like work to me because these guys are like my friends.
Wow, that's cool. That's really amazing that and this may be a cultural as well. Is this the norm in Japan for business social events, that, you know, it is quite like drinks oriented and that can go quite late? Or is that, you know, would that happen in Australia as well?
That wouldn't happen in Australia. I think just how culture set up, that you would see typically like more of these drinking parties in more traditional Japanese companies and cultures. Yeah. I think, you know, when we're together, we're just talking about the latest topics, like how is ChatGPT affecting cybersecurity?
Right.
Or talking about the latest video games, talking about anything as well. So it's really, you're kind of just hanging out after the event with your friends in that sense.
Right. I can see, yeah, like, you must get to know people so well compared to a typical recruiter client, you know, or recruiter candidate relationship. Because when would you be spending hours and hours? And obviously when people have a drink, then they, you know, they're more relaxed. They let their guard down. They're more open, more, you know, the conversation is more free flowing. But like you're spending hours with people. So that must really accelerate the relationship.
Absolutely. So this is where you're building relationships at scale, not only at the event where, you know, you're facilitating questions, you're facilitating the flow of the program. So instead of spending 1 hour with one person, you're spending 80 hours in one go, in 1 hour, because of how many people are there, right? Quite often you hear the term that information is power, especially in a recruitment game. Quite often I get the privilege to know what's happening in a person's organization, sometimes before they even know what's happening, who's moving, who's leaving the organization. That information is quite useful, you know, as you make commercial decisions in our role.
There's so much I want to pick up on here. You mentioned that, because I was surprised you get 80% of people to turn up. Normally, if it's a free event, you'd be lucky to get 50% of people to come along, but you're getting 80%. And I think not only is it because people learn about this event on LinkedIn and they see like people they know, and they can see that this is a high quality thing that is worth attending, but also you've made it quite exclusive, and you have that lottery where you get more people who register than you have spaces for. So there is a real, it makes it more special and more sought after to like, oh, I hope I get a place. That then if you get a place, you're much more likely to, I think you would really make a huge effort to show up unless there was something that came up that really prevented you from coming. So I think that is, you've figured out a lot of nuances, Stephen, which are cool, that running events and corporate events is not new, right? This is not a new idea, but you've really tweaked it and finessed it and made it so powerful. Any other kind of nuances or things that you figured out that you think have made your events really successful?
So one thing that I've noticed though is that you do have to be careful on the content that is being mm-hmm. shared throughout that event. So you do not want to have like a product vendor come in and sell or demo their product. Because
yes.
people don't want to be sold something on a Friday night.
Right.
They are much more interested in, you know, engaging with something that's relevant to them, whether it's a piece of work that someone else is doing, like a piece of engineering work and that's relevant to them, or yep. it's to catch up with their friends. So it's really about, you know, making sure that structured component is as short as possible, not as short as possible, but it's timely for a Friday night.
Yeah.
Which is typically less than an hour for me.
Yeah.
And you know, making people feel comfortable during those events. So, you know, to be honest, like having 80 people at that event is quite overwhelming, right? If you have to manage everything, it is very, very overwhelming. You need to make sure you empower your team, empower the local or regular members that come to do pieces of work. So I was very lucky that I have my team there, someone to help people with registration and check-in, sound check and mics, making sure that people are distributing and networking with other people, making sure that, you know, it's very hard to talk with people all the time. So if I can't spend that much time with someone, I'll make sure I'll introduce them to someone before I leave them, right? So it's like, hey, you should talk to this person because they're doing something similar to what you're working on. Well, let me introduce you to that person. And you know you're kind of
connector.
You're kind of connecting people with common interests together, and you'll give yeah. them some sort of spark to talk about. Now some of the things that people have said to me is like, oh, but Stephen, what if we introduce all these people who are, you know, clients and candidates are coming to them? What if they go directly for a job?
Yes.
Right.
I'm glad you raised that because I'm sure that's going to be an objection that people have to doing this kind of thing.
Yeah, so that is a legitimate concern. What we find in the Japan market, and perhaps this is a cultural thing, is that people do remember and say, hey, you know, I met so-and-so from your meetup. It sounded like the type of work they're doing and the challenges that they're working on are very interesting to what I want to do in my career. So someone actually said this to me. And they said, what would be the next steps to take this conversation further? Right. And
nice.
they obviously got placed, but I would have no idea that that person was looking for a new job.
Right. Yes.
So it opens up these conversations that you weren't aware of. Surely it might be different in some other markets and you might have some sort of slippage where people mm-hmm. might go direct. But also think about, well, what is the opportunity that I'm missing out on if I don't do this?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. I agree 100%, Stephen. I think people, and this is, I understand where this comes from. And I think a lot of recruiters would feel like, oh, but I'm going to miss out on placements because people are going to meet each other and that will naturally result in them getting together, you know, outside of the event. And I have no control or even, I may not even know, and they may hire somebody as a direct result of the event, and I'll miss out on a placement. But that's the wrong perspective. You need to think about it from the point of view of how many more placements, like it's like the benefits by far outweigh the potential for or the risk of losing out on a couple of placements, because how many more placements will you make as a result of this strategy than if you had never done it in the first place? So I think people, maybe that's cultural to Japan. I think that in a lot of markets, the client and the candidate may not be so respectful or thoughtful of how this conversation, you know, how this introduction originated, and they may go direct to each other. And I think you need to make peace with that and just not worry about it too much.
Yeah. And there's a certain element of follow-up as well. If that is the case, making sure you follow up with each other's people, say, hey, how was the event? Do you have any interesting conversations? And, you know, what do you think of this? You just run it by them and they'll probably volunteer that information. Hey, I'm thinking about applying for this company perhaps. And So it does require a follow-up or an outreach to figure out what's on that person's mind, what they're going to do next.
That's a great point. Love it. That it's not like you leave it, you have the event and you say, okay, see you later. There's like a follow-up process to cement those relationships and also get a chance to hear, you know, what their thoughts were of the event and what, I love it, Stephen. This is brilliant. Listen, I do want to spend some time on your career at, you know, at Robert Half and what else you've done to support your team and also to develop yourself. Could you say a little bit more on that?
It's a great question. So there's two parts. One is on the leadership and team management angle. The other is on innovation, process, and tools too.
Okay.
So first of all, on the leadership side, I actually pay for a leadership coach.
Awesome.
I recognize the value in having a coach. I know that as a leader, I don't have enough reference points. What's normal? Like, you know, what you experience as a top builder is very different from what you experience as a leader. So this is where I would pay for someone who was highly referred to me. I would bounce ideas off them and they would give me unfiltered and say, hey, Stephen, don't you sound a little bit arrogant when you say this? Or don't you sound a little bit judgmental when you say that? So they really do keep you grounded and they're not afraid to say those types of things, but in a respectful way. I found that to be extremely, extremely helpful. And it's helped me navigate some difficult conversations about people on the team or what I'm experiencing as I step up into leadership as well. You know, for example, you'll know that trying to get change through at your peer level is much harder compared to getting change through with the people that you manage directly as
True.
A case in point. And she'll help you navigate that. I also got paired up with a mentor internally within Robert Half. He's a managing director in Melbourne, and he's been able to give me some more reference points with the context of the Robert Half lens, which has been really helpful too. Now, if I think about the team management side, when you do run these events with a team, you do have to change the way that certain models work, right? Because you have, in Robert Half, you have a candidate ownership model. And then you also have a client ownership model. And I tell the team, like, okay, well, by that definition, every single person that comes to those events would be hence like my candidate ownership. But I don't think that works for the candidate or my team because I don't have enough time to go and follow up individually. So I always say to the team, I'll just reward the person who makes that deal happen. So it's basically open. If you're the person who's proactive enough to engage that person, even though it's an introduction from me, go and make it happen. And I also tell them, I also flip the model and say, you know that person, you met a lot of the clients that I know. So I own a lot of the client relationships as well. I'll say to them, why don't you do execution for that deal too? So even though it's my candidate that I know from the meetup, it's my client that I know, but I'm getting the team to work and facilitate execution. Now, the benefits of that is they're empowered and they don't feel like, am I going to upset Stephen by talking to their candidate or client? They're empowered to say, like, what's the best for this candidate? What's the best service that I can operate? And they're dealing with a single point of contact. I'll help step in when things get difficult when it comes to perhaps things like salary negotiation, or a deep concern that a client has about the candidate, I'll step in there. And it allows me to be agile to really play a role where I'm overseeing things and not getting lost in the day-to-day details of execution. And what I'll do is I'll adjust the splits. So I know I can't adjust commission schemes, but I can adjust sales credit. And I'll say to the team, since you did more work, I'm going to allocate more sales credit to you. And by doing that, we can multiply the impact of how many people we help and serve in the marketplace.
This is awesome, Stephen. As you're talking, what the thing that jumped out at me is a lot of people struggle to make this transition from producer to manager or leader. And because it's a different skill set and it's a different mindset, And what I mean by that is the skills that allow you to do deals and run a successful desk. Of course, there's some transferable ones, but it largely is different than skill set of managing and leading people. And so a lot, we see this with a lot of our clients who they often will set up their own business because they were really successful producers. And then they start hiring people, use the word reference points. They don't have those leadership skills. They're awesome at being recruiters and doing deals, but this is a whole different ballgame, is developing as a leader. And if you want to grow a business, then you need those leadership skills. But there's also the mindset shift, because a lot of individual contributors who are like top billers can have a little bit of a selfish orientation. And in order to be a really good manager and leader, your job is to make your team successful, right? And I've seen a lot of people who don't make it as a billing manager because although they're responsible for other people, they're really still all about themselves. And it just doesn't work.
You're absolutely right. And you do have to let go, because you are now responsible for these human beings, which, you know, you serve in that sense. It's not them kind of serving you in that sense, but it's you serving them. I was very fortunate to have some really good examples from my boss, Lindsay Hughes, who's really led by example on that. There's another book by Liz Ryan called Multipliers, where she highlights an example from Mitt Romney. Everyone wanted to work for his team when he was at, I think, Boston Consulting Group or McKinsey. Everyone wanted to work on his team because people knew that if you worked for him, your careers would grow. So just in the example for my own team is getting them to focus more on execution and deals and being responsible for tricky situations, they learn. They grow their careers. Absolutely. They're not stuck doing a single piece of work. Like, you know, I think a lot of other people would just say you're just stuck on candidate sourcing. But all of a sudden now you get more reference points on difficult things you get to deal with, whether it's salary negotiation, whether it's business development, whether it's public speaking and doing these events yourself. And we've seen that happen where my team has proactively started to do a Japanese version of these cybersecurity meetups, right? They're growing in their careers, and it's giving them space to say that, hey, I really feel empowered to do this myself and do things.
Wow, that's amazing. Stephen, I'm astonished at how much you've accomplished in just 3.5 years. It's a little bit like the expression that someone can have 5 years experience on paper, but really they only have 1 year of experience repeated 5 times. You've packed, you're the opposite. Like, you've really someone who, you might look at someone's resume or their LinkedIn profile and say, oh, they only have 3 years, so they're going to be, you know, still relatively junior in their career. But you have 3 years on paper, but more like 10 years in terms of what you've actually accomplished.
So that's a really good point that reminds me of, so Robin Sharma, he's also like a leadership coach, and he talks about this idea of compressing time. How do you compress time in learning? And I, you know, even though I only had 3 years of experience in recruiting, I feel like I've been practicing for about 10 years because I've been reading, I've read over like 100 books on leadership, communication, and team dynamics. So I feel like all that comes back now when I'm implementing it into my game.
Absolutely. It's a great analogy. Are you in the 5 a.m. club? Is that, because that's Robin Sharma's most famous.
That's Robin Sharma's famous. Yeah. I wish I could wake up that early. I tend to stretch my day longer because I do some other activities afterwards. But something to work towards.
Well, yeah, exactly. So the coincidentally about Robin Sharma, he's from Nova Scotia, the same as me. And he actually went to the same university as me, but he's a couple of years older. So I only heard of him like in the last 5 years. He wrote the book, The Monk Who Sold His Ferrari. But so I only actually discovered him recently, but then I looked at his Wikipedia and I'm like, holy cow, he's from the same place as me. So
what a small world. No, I started with that same book, The Monk That Sold His Ferrari, back in 2012. And I was listening to his podcast daily, and some of his podcasts I listen to like 5, 6, 7 times.
It's interesting because he's a really powerful speaker. If you see his videos on YouTube and stuff, he's just so polished and he's an excellent speaker. I found that, and I haven't read that one. I've read the 5 a.m. Club and I just didn't get into it. I found like, because it's told, it's like an allegory and it's like told as a story rather than as like more of an instruction manual. I found it hard to really get into it. What was your experience with that?
Same as well.
Yeah. As well. But not taking away from his knowledge on leadership for sure. Stephen, do you know what? We sort of are running out of time to talk about your other thing that you're doing internally, which is the other thing you're doing internally, which is on the tech side of things and tools. So I'm going to suggest, like, let's do this again. Like, I'd love to continue the conversation. This has been so beneficial and so powerful. What I appreciate about you is, you've been so, specific in giving actionable strategies that other people can learn from and adopt. And I really appreciate that. 'Cause a lot of, you know, people who are successful don't necessarily want to share, help others. So that's awesome, man. I really appreciate you. And I'm so glad that you reached out and told me the conclusion. 'Cause I do remember clearly that conversation we had three years ago, and it was only short. I think we only talked for 15 or, you know, 20 minutes. And so it's so awesome to hear back from you about how things have developed since then. I really appreciate you.
I think that's super nice. Like as you become successful in your career, don't forget the people that helped you. So I think it's always nice to just drop them a quick message and say, hey, thanks so much for that advice you gave me. It really got me through a hard time or difficult time, or because of that, I'm here where I am now. I think people sometimes forget that, but it's also nice to be on the receiving end that what you are doing is making a difference on that side. If I was to finish with one thing about events, just going back to the topic of events, what makes it powerful? And you said like how a lot of people come to those events. I think having a mission that goes beyond you as the individual really helps. So our mission is to build a stronger cybersecurity community in Japan by giving people the platform to share the best ideas and thoughts. One of the problems that I saw, and this was addressed in our senior leaders meetup, was that companies, there's no strong regulation in Japan requiring companies to disclose when breaches occur. So let's say a company gets hacked, there's a ransomware case against them. Sometimes in Japan society, like, we can understand if you don't want to disclose that because it's, you know, you don't want to bring shame to your company. You don't want to release that. So that's kind of the reality of the environment. But because that happens, it can hurt other companies who may be vulnerable to a similar type of attack. So because that company didn't share that, hey, we got hacked and this is how we got hacked, these were some of the deficiencies in our controls, our systems, other companies can't say like, hang on, we have the same deficiency in our controls, maybe I should get that fixed. So what we did is we talked about a topic of called ransomware resilience, and we had someone share a real life experience of when their company was hacked, and you could see the pain in his eyes as he's sharing this experience because it was stressful. He had to work like a overnight shift to basically cover, because you know when that happens, it's everyone's on deck, and you need to have a rotating roster that there's someone available 24/7 to make a call on things. And so he was able to share pieces of insight that were useful for the audience. And they would also talk about and naturally want to say, okay, this is what I had in my experience. How did you deal with that? It gets the conversation going. So because we've developed that type of mission and people are involved, it's not just my meetup. People are really on board with coming, and they always ask you, when's the next one? When's the next one? People want to be involved, and that's how you can kind of start building relationships at scale. That's how you can start creating something that goes beyond yourself.
That's a perfect way to finish off the conversation, Stephen. That's so powerful and such a, it is nuanced, but it's a powerful insight is if you can create a mission that's bigger than yourself or your business, it makes it, people want to enroll in that mission and support it because they benefit from it as well and they believe in it. So when you're enrolling people on that mission, they're not saying this, they're not directly saying, oh, Stephen's the best recruiter, or I want to help Robert have to be successful. They're buying into the overall mission that you can share together. And I think, yeah, it's beautiful what you've done. Stephen, thank you so much. And I'll be watching your progress very closely because I can't wait to see where you go next.
Appreciate it. And if just one last comment on our side, just for all the recruiters listening here, I know you've got a lot of people from UK and the US. Japan is a lucrative market where they have 35 to 40% fees. Our company does hire experienced recruiters and value those from other markets to come to Japan. So if you're thinking about, you know, a career here in Japan, we'd love to talk to you.
Awesome. Yeah, definitely. Like, follow Stephen on LinkedIn, connect with him. It's Stephen Lee, L-I. And because you'll see the stuff he's doing on LinkedIn, which is awesome. You'll see how he's promoting the events, but definitely connect in with them. And if you want that experience of, you know, developing your career in another country, that sounds like an awesome opportunity. So I hope you get some interest on that, Stephen.
For sure. Thank you so much again, Mark. Good to see you. And yeah, hope to catch up with you again soon.
Wow. That was an awesome session with Stephen Lee. I hope you enjoyed it as much as I did. My top three takeaways were, number one, community. Stephen talked about building relationships at scale. I love that expression, by creating a community. And he shared so many key insights on how he's been able to do that successfully. Number two, mission. If you have a clear mission that is bigger than you and your company, but is one that your whole market can get behind, then people will go out of their way to help you. This is one I'm really going to be thinking about how I can apply to my work and what we do at Recruitment Coach. Number three was regarding leadership. We all know that top billers don't necessarily make good managers. And I think the reason Stephen has fast-tracked his career is because he's taken responsibility for his own development, and he's proactively seeking to refine his leadership skills through books, through mentorship, and through coaching. So community, mission, leadership, my top three golden nuggets from today. What were yours? I'd love to hear from you. Send me a LinkedIn message, or even better, leave a review for the show sharing what you thought of this episode and what your key takeaways were. We would love to hear your feedback. Have an awesome day.